This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
We got a snapshot of some of the nuts and bolts of this economy today, and honestly, it's not great. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 10th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It doesn't get too terribly much credit from the public at large, but the Census Bureau does a whole lot of economic data gathering, which makes sense, right? They ask, and then from time to time, they share with us what they have learned. And this morning, they shared some data on income and poverty and health insurance. The insurance thing we'll get to in a bit. Income and poverty goes first. And honestly, it's a bit of a head-scratcher because even though unemployment is at near-record lows and wages are rising some, median household income in this country was basically flat last year. So with that as prologue, Marketplace's Andy Euler starts us off.
New data from the Census Bureau on how much Americans are taking home has some economists like Bruce Sacerdote at Dartmouth College scratching their heads.
It's a puzzle. The economy's been in expansion for a long time. There's a lot of business optimism out there. There's reasonable but not stellar GDP growth, so you should, of course, expect to see people taking more home.
And some are, but Sacerdote says those taking home more are generally in the higher tax brackets. Big picture, the median U.S. household income was only about $500 higher last year than in 2017, which economists say is statistically insignificant. Sacerdote also warns not to make too much of this one-year stagnation because the previous 4 years saw decent jumps in household income.
The bad news is that it was flat this year, but the medium-run trend is not horrible.
The Census Bureau also reports the national poverty rate fell for the fourth straight year, down 0.5% from last year. Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute says that's a step in the right direction, but she's waiting for the supplemental report, which zeroes in on poverty at the county and city level.
Because it takes into account housing costs that are different across the country. So it's important to really get that local flavor to know how people are really doing.
She says making matters worse for Americans who are struggling is that healthcare costs are eating up more of their pay. Today's census data also showed that the share of Americans without health insurance rose last year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Speaking of which, that health insurance thing, that is the other huge part of the data that the Census Bureau released today about another huge part of this economy. So we have called Sarah Cliff to get some context on that. She covers health policy for the New York Times. Sarah, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
So with what else is in this census report today, we wanted to get some perspective on this healthcare thing from you and the uninsured levels. First of all, were you surprised given the rest of the data of the town?
I was. Usually when you have a report that shows a strong economy, strong income, you have an increase in health insurance. But this is a report where you have people's earnings going up, but the uninsured rate is going up too. So that was definitely a surprise to me.
Okay, so what gives? How come?
That is a great question that I think a lot of experts and economists are puzzling over. The other thing that's notable about this report is it's the first one where we've seen the uninsured rate increase since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. So something different is definitely happening. It has to do, I think, with the economy. It has to do with how the Trump administration treats the Affordable Care Act. There's a lot of different factors going on that seem to be driving the uninsured rate up.
You do a lot of investigative work on people's insurance bills, right? You go out on Twitter and ask them to send you your bills. You've done a bunch of this coverage. Do you see this reflected in your research and in your investigative reporting?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you certainly see are people questioning whether insurance is a good deal as deductibles rise. I talk to people who say, I'm paying hundreds in premiums each month, and then I have like a $6,000 deductible. Is it even worth it? The other thing I see a lot of, and I think what's reflected in this report, is that you do see people gaining jobs, but those jobs tend to be low wage, and low wage jobs often don't come with health benefits. So that's another place where people are kind of falling into the cracks, and helps kind of square that circle of why you might see incomes getting better, but the uninsured rate, you know, getting worse.
It's kind of a disconnect, right? I mean, it's a little bit like the Fed and inflation. They kind of go, yeah, I don't know what's up with inflation. And here you've got the same thing with jobs and healthcare.
It is, and it might signal kind of a changing health insurance environment, where before the assumption was, you know, a job comes with health insurance, that health insurance will pay your medical bills. Now the job might come with health insurance and it might pay your medical bills. And I think that's a really big trend we're seeing over the past decade that's going to create this divergence between two trends that used to run hand in hand.
Characterize it for me. Is it troubling? I mean, you know, you do this professionally.
I think it is. I think the other part of this report we haven't talked about is that we see a significant decline in Medicaid coverage. Mm-hmm. That's the program that covers low-income Americans. It's a public program. And that's actually where you see the steepest decline. And so that suggests you might have some tightening of eligibility rules that have been approved by the Trump administration. You might have people who think Obamacare was repealed aren't going to look for coverage. So it definitely is a troubling report because, you know, the people who are losing Medicaid, they tend to be a population that is lower income.
Crystal ball it now. As we head into 2020 and this becomes, healthcare becomes a campaign issue, does this muddy the water or clear it up?
I think it muddies the water. It raises some questions about, you know, who are these people who are losing health insurance? Can a strong economy also ensure that Americans' healthcare bills get paid? And this report is suggesting maybe it doesn't. Maybe people are feeling a little more secure with their new jobs, but they don't have that security around their medical bills. So I think that's, you know, definitely a big area of concern that'll play into, you know, the election as we get underway.
Sarah Cliff, investigative reporter at the New York Times, does a lot of health policy stuff there for him. Sarah, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The politico-economic commodity of the day on this Tuesday is crude oil. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate lost about 0.8% at the close in New York. Why, Kai, I hear you asking? Well, noted foreign policy hawk John Bolton, until this morning, the National Security Advisor no longer has that job. So oil traders breathe a little bit easier, maybe cross their fingers that Iranian crude might be coming back on the markets. Dateline Cupertino, California. This next item, the annual Apple product extravaganza. A couple of new phones, a new watch, Apple TV Plus, some other things. Investors were moderately pleased. Shares up a bit more than 1% today. On Wall Street proper, the major indices just about broke even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You ready for Thursday night? I mean, the next round of Democratic debates, of course. The candidates who made the cut, that is. There will be gotcha moments and tweet-worthy exchanges, but really, mostly, it's about the money. Behind the scenes, and this goes for the top of the ticket, down-ballot races, Dems, and the GOP, every campaign this season is going to be looking to monetize every useful moment from here on out. And as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington, when the donations do come, candidates will not be the only ones cashing in.
The Houston debate is an opportunity for 10 Democratic candidates to make their pitch to voters and for all the candidates, Democrat and Republican, on stage and off, to use the debate as an excuse to ask for money.
You can give at amyklobuchar.com.
Go to corybooker.com.
MarkSanford.com.
Go to joewalsh.org.
Click on the link. Donate now.
That last voice was Democratic candidate Tulsi Gabbard. All those clicks have helped 2020 presidential candidates raise almost $400 million so far. And nearly all of those donations made online come with a fee, usually around 3-4%, paid by donors. Some of that goes to the credit card companies, and some goes to the processing platform. For the Democrats, that platform is almost always ActBlue.
We will end up working with pretty much every registered Democrat on the federal level and at the state and local down to municipal level across the country.
Erin Hill is the executive director of Act Blue. She says since virtually every Democrat is using the platform, it's become a one-stop shop for Democratic donors supporting candidates up and down the ballot.
They're able to give just by choosing which candidate, which organization, and how much.
Act Blue is a nonprofit and relies on donor tips to fund much of its day-to-day costs, but its success has encouraged plenty of for-profit competitors who would like their own slice of those processing fees, which can add up to millions of dollars in a presidential campaign.
There's so much political money flowing around right now that the ecosystem can support plenty of different platforms.
Colin Delaney is editor of ePolitics.com and has been following online political donations for years. The ecosystem also includes companies like NGP Van, Campaign Solutions, and Anadot. And Republicans recently launched their own nonprofit, Win Red. Delaney says they're trying to create an Act Blue equivalent, but
they're doing it differently than the Democrats did, though, because they're trying to require campaigns to use it.
Trying, although there have been several reports some campaigns and state parties are resisting. But WinRed is the official processor for the campaign likely to pull in the most GOP cash, the campaign to reelect President Trump, and not his Republican opponents.
So it probably will not surprise you to learn that, lo and behold, WinRed was not interested in working with the Walsh for President campaign.
That's Lucy Caldwell. She's the campaign manager for Republican Joe Walsh, when Red declined an interview with Marketplace. Caldwell says limiting which candidates can use the platform could unintentionally limit GOP fundraising overall.
I think that software really serving the purpose of being software, not the purpose of picking winners and losers, is a really good thing for donors and for our system of democracy overall.
For now, all three of President Trump's primary challengers are using Anadot. The 2020 Democratic presidential campaigns are all using Act Blue. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
I'm going to read you a new company branding slogan. You are going to tell me what company it is, okay? And I should tell you, by way of hint, that it's a $130 billion enterprise. It is a giant in its field, and this is going to be the giveaway for some of you. It owns and has put its name on the tallest building in San Francisco. But still, the quiz. Here's the slogan. We bring companies and customers together. Anybody get it? I mean, people who don't live in San Francisco? Salesforce is the company. And now the question is, what does we bring companies and customers together even mean? Megan Graham of CNBC wrote about Salesforce and its new slogan and what that company actually does. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, so look, in 30 seconds or less, I know we just had the branding slogan. I need you to tell me what Salesforce actually does.
So that's a tricky one, Kai, actually, because they do so much. Really started with kind of customer relationship management software. And in the last few years, it's really kind of burgeoned because they've just been on this total acquisition spree. So I guess the answer to your question is it's complicated, but they're trying to make it less complicated for people.
There's an example in this piece about the shoe salesman and like the woman at home shopping. Give me that example because that'll crystallize it, I think.
So what they're trying to do is basically give contextual examples. So, I mean, if you look at their website, it's a little bit wonky. It's like Salesforce is a customer relationship management solution that brings companies and customers together. So they're trying to make it a little bit more specified. If you're a retailer, they want you to say, okay, I could use these solutions to say, okay, I could show you a shoe that your customer might like. I could show them a jacket. And just to kind of give a little bit more of a visual, and that's going to show you something along those lines and also kind of bring you to more specific websites and things like that where you can get more information and see case studies and things like that.
How do they know what kind of shoe I might like in that shoe sales example?
Well, so the sort of legacy business here, right, was this customer relationship management. So any retailer that's kind of digitally savvy is going to know what's the last time you bought shoes, what kind of shoes you like, kind of what season, it all sorts of things. So they have all this data on you, not you, Kai, but someone right. with your profile. So they might say, okay, last time Kai bought shoes was, you know, this many years ago. He's probably in the market for a new pair of brown leather shoes because we know he likes right. those because he bought those then and he might like them again.
God, Salesforce really does know me. It's terrifying. Terrifying.
Well, that's, yeah, just sort of the digital right. e-commerce these right. days, they do have a lot of info on you. And that's stuff that, I mean, if you're logged in, you know, right. it's fair game and it's probably stuff you want to.
Why is Salesforce so eager to have people understand what it does? I mean, this company's been around forever. It's worth $130 billion. But really, I just want to go about my day and get the products I want. Why does Salesforce want the branding thing?
Well, I think they could, what they've done over the last, I think it's been 5 years, they've had this sort of brand awareness study that they do. And they've realized that it's kind of everywhere. But when you ask someone like, okay, well, what do? They've realized that there's just even more opportunity with what they're describing as sort of business decision makers to say, okay, here's people who maybe they work at a small business, something like retail, I don't know, a small retailer that might not know that Salesforce could do something for them. They really want to kind of break into those people too.
Is it going to work?
I guess we'll see. I mean, it makes it a little bit more sense than just sort of these broad, you know, descriptions that could apply to literally any industry in any part of the world of any size.
Megan Graham covers advertising marketing as well at CNBC.com. Megan, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
we have a saying, whichever way your relationship is going, it'll get there faster on a tandem.
Love and bicycles. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 73 points today, about 0.25%, 26,909. The NASDAQ down 3 points, less than 0.1%, finished at 8,084. The S&P 500 basically flat, 29.79 there. A couple of Apple details here for you. Streaming service, Apple TV Plus, will launch on the 1st of November with subscriptions priced at $4.99 a month. And thus, competitors fell in today's trading. Netflix dropped 2.1%. Disney, also launching its streaming service, by the way, in November, fell 2.1%. Wendy's said plans to expand its breakfast offerings next year. We're going to slow its growth this year. Stock suffered as a result, losing 10%. McDonald's announced it's acquiring a tech startup that's going to help it improve voice-activated ordering in its drive-thrus. Investors said thank you, no. McDonald's shed 3.5%. Today you're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We were talking earlier in the program about that census report on household incomes. We also learned this week that a bunch of big retailers have started to staff up for the holiday shopping season. Target's looking for 130,000 people. UPS needs 100,000. Amazon and Kohl's are hiring as well. And that prompts this nod to the calendar. It's September, people. But I guess such is life in a tight labor market, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
There's a lot of competition for seasonal workers this year. So companies are offering all kinds of incentives, like Target's 10% discount for employees. Teresa Ghilarducci is a labor economist at the New School.
people really like those kinds of incentive because people who work at Christmas also are people who have to buy Christmas and other holiday presents.
Seasonal work at shipping companies like UPS appeals to workers whose normal jobs are slow during the holiday season. That includes a lot of farmers, says Satish Jindal at ShipMatrix.
And the other one are college students who have holiday time in the winter, plus they can work at nighttime and still go to school in the daytime.
UPS is offering to pay seasonal workers up to $1,300 in tuition reimbursement. But perks are one thing. Peter Erasm at Iowa State University says seasonal work is starting to pay more, too.
So in general, an hour of work is rewarding people more than it has in the past.
That's because we'd expect companies to pay more when unemployment is so low, says Teresa Ghilarducci at the New School.
In a tight labor market, you would have to induce people who normally wouldn't work, which means that employers would have to pay a little bit more.
UPS says its starting rate this year is $14 an hour, up from around $10 last year. Target will pay $13 an hour. It raised its overall minimum wage in June. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Today in corporate debt stories, the Ford Motor Company. A couple of CEOs ago, Ford tried to rebrand itself as a mobility company rather than just a car company. That high-tech futuristic plan did not really take in the minds of investors. The CEO who came up with it is no longer CEO. And to judge by the news today, things have not improved. Moody's has downgraded Ford's credit rating to junk, citing, and this is a quote, considerable operating and market challenges. Junk debt is going to make it more expensive for Ford to borrow money. So what to do? Restructure for an uncertain future or keep on pumping out profitable vehicles today? Marketplace's Jack Stewart is on that one.
The investor service Moody's says Ford faces weak earnings and cash flow issues as it restructures for the future. Bruce Clark from Moody's.
Ford allowed a lot of inefficiencies to work its way into its system when the markets were relatively good.
Ford is one of Detroit's iconic big three. It's credited with making the motor car mainstream a century ago. But like all car companies, it has to face massive looming changes. This is then CEO Mark Fields at the LA Auto Show in 2016.
Ford has decided to take an expansive view of mobility.
That included self-driving cars, electric vehicles, and even e-scooters and dockless bikes.
Well, I think the problem is that they're investing in these future technologies, and the average consumer is not quite ready for those yet.
Jessica Caldwell at Edmunds.
So they are, you know, still producing Ford F-150s, their big pickup truck, and that is their cash cow, and that's what they're making money on.
Ford's F-series of pickup trucks are America's best-selling vehicles of any type and have been for almost four decades. But overall, Ford has lost market share recently. Longtime industry analyst John Gabrielson says the company could have cut costs during that time, but didn't, and that could really become an issue in a recession.
When you're in the up cycle, you don't really notice that. But when you go into the down cycle, if you have, say, 25% less market share, that's a massive difference.
In a statement, Ford says its balance sheet is solid and it's confident in its plan and progress. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Exactly where this economy is going, but we do know that wherever it winds up, it will have been a ride. That's the somewhat tortured toss to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
Hi, my name's Diane Jenks. I'm the co-owner of Hubbub Bicycles with my husband, Brian. We are in Northeast Ohio in a little town called Kirtland. We fit, design, and build custom bicycles for the cycling enthusiast. It's sort of like the Brian and Diane show when you come to Hubbub. And everybody says, okay, here's the classic comment. You own a bike shop, you must ride a lot. Which, of course, is totally not true because the time that we're working is the time people want to be riding. But actually, my husband and I ride a tandem together. We have a saying, whichever way your relationship is going, it'll get there faster on a tandem. So people either fall in love or fall out of love on a tandem. So the local bicycle shop, I think, is suffering right now from maybe a lack of excitement about the business, because the business feels like it's slipping away when you can just go online and order something. So you have to reinvent yourself. We did away with things like shoes and shorts and gloves and jerseys and the things that now there is no way to compete with online. But nobody can really compete with wheel building, frame design, and fabulous customer service. One of our favorite stories, we go back to 2004. And this gentleman came into the store, and he was being told, because he was having trouble with his back, that he could just either go to an upright bike or just ride a couple of miles or just give up cycling altogether. That was not in the picture for him. And his goal was to be able to comfortably ride 25 miles. Brian built the bike. We send him out. And a week later, he's riding 50 miles at a time. And suddenly he's riding century rides, which is 100 miles at a time. Fast forward to this past weekend, he rode his fourth century for the year, and he turned 80 this year. And he always tells us we changed his life for the better. I mean, you can't buy that anywhere. And it's just, that's what makes our business so much fun.
Diane Jenks from Hubbub Bicycles in Kirkland, Ohio. You know, we can't do this segment without you, so please take a second. Tell us what's going on in your economy, would you? Marketplace.org is where you can do that. This final note on the way out today, in which Hasbro updates a classic game to reflect modern reality. You know Monopoly, right? You pass go, collect $200, buy a properties. I always like the green ones. But anyway, try now Ms. Monopoly. Women get $240 when they pass go. Men get $200. Instead of properties, you buy things women invented, like Wi-Fi. Bet you didn't know that, did you? Also, chocolate chip cookies. Also, and not for nothing, but Molly Wood and I on the podcast that we do together called Make Me Smart, we did an episode just today on exactly this, the gender imbalance in the workplace. Emily Bazelon from the New York Times and Slate joined us. Check it out. I'm sure there's a link somewhere on marketplace.org. All right, we're done. Dow Industrial's up 73 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ down 3, less than 0.1%. S&P 500 basically flat. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Mutti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.